Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. And I'm very sorry, actually, for the amount of time it's taking between the episodes here. I actually finished this book around about 2 weeks ago and I've only just got around to doing it. And mainly just because after my last trip, I've got home and it's spring in Berlin. And I guess I'm just a bit too distracted. Reading is, and doing this podcast, and actually doing quite a lot of different things that I need to be getting on with in life, is taking a backseat to the juggling projects that I'm working on and the music that I'm doing and even writing that I'm doing as well. And I've just been doing less reading, and I guess, I don't know what it is. Maybe there's just a few books that I've read recently that I didn't enjoy. I sort of like lost a bit of motivation to read and things like that. I'm not sure why, and also to do this podcast. And again, I don't know why that either, because every time I do the podcast, I just sit down and start talking. And I always really enjoy doing the podcast when I just actually start it, but I was thinking, oh, it's going to be work and stuff like that. And I know it's just a phase that I'm going through, but I have been doing this podcast for what, 3 years now? I can't remember when I started. It's been going for quite a long time. And so, yeah, I might as well just get into, you know, try and get into some more books. I'm not sure. I think I might just read a few books that I've read before so I can relax into the reading of them and don't need to think too much about it. I'm not sure. Someone mentioned Lord Valentine's Castle by Robert Silverberg, and they said, oh, it's a pity you're not going to read this, because I think I've already read it two times before, at least twice before, but maybe I'll give it a go on audiobook, see if it's on audible.com. I've got lots of credits building up there as I'm trying to get through some different podcasts and things like that. Anyway, so talking of writing projects and things, I'm actually around about a third of the way through a fantasy novel that I'm writing myself, and if anyone out there would like to read over what I've had so far, I'm looking for maybe two or three people or something like that to check out what I've got, just to give a bit of feedback, because I'm sort of at a crossroads, or not a crossroads, a T junction, a Y junction, some kind of, traffic road-based metaphor in the book, and I just need some advice about which direction to take. So what I'm wanting to do is give the book to some people without any explanation or without any sort of saying what the book is or anything about it, and just read it and see if it starts making sense to you, or see if you can actually pick up what's going on, and any questions that you would like answered, and hopefully by getting that feedback from some fresh readers who don't know anything about the project, and I don't give them any hints about it, they just get the text and start reading. Maybe it'll guide me in that. So if you want to check that out, you just email me. luke@juggler.net is the best way to get in touch, and just say, hey, I want to check out your novel, working title Arc of Life. Or Arc of Life, Book 1. Well, to see how it goes. Anyway, I'm quite enjoying it. I'm really impressed with it so far when I read back over it after taking some time off. But I want to make sure that other people feel the same way, that it doesn't just make sense just to me because I wrote it. Right, on to today's book review. It's called Maelstrom, and this book was written by an author called Peter Watts, who's a Canadian author from Canada. No, I'm not going to get into that. This is a follow-up book that he wrote in 2001 to a novel called Starfish, which I actually reviewed on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. Let me just check the list here, and that was back in episode 91. Also, episode 80, I reviewed Blindsight, but that's his more recent novel, more recent novel, let me put it that way. But yeah, so there was Starfish, which I think I gave 3.5 stars to. I really enjoyed it. Good book, and then this is the follow-up. So it's around about, 384 pages, it says here on goodreads.com. And so let's just get straight into it. So at the end of Starfish, well, this is the weird thing to review a book, the second book in a series. I think this is three second book in a series that I've done in a row here. But the world, it's sort of set in 2090 or something, or maybe, or, you know, 2100, sometime at the end of this century. And again, I want to avoid spoilers for Starfish, so if you haven't read that book, at the end of that book, Lenny Clark, who is our hero or anti-hero in that book, she survives, but the power station, which is on the vent at the bottom of the ocean floor, doesn't survive. That book was set pretty much entirely on the bottom of the ocean. If you've seen the film The Abyss, which is this not a power station, it's a drilling rig down at the bottom of the ocean. This is, you know, a similar kind of thing, but they're going down to the ocean vents and getting power directly, like electrical power directly from the heat transfer at the vents at the bottom of the ocean. But we didn't really find out very much about the wider world, because everything in that book happened, it all takes place on this one ocean vent, you know, undersea, sub-ocean, you know, power station. You know, they're all just hanging out there together. But that's destroyed at the end. So what happens is that Lenny Clark, she comes out to see the wider world. And of course, this book is then set in the wider world, in North America, which has been abbreviated to N-A-M in the book. And so I always just pronounce that Nam, as in North America, Nam. But that always sounds a bit like Nam as in Vietnam. But maybe that's intentional, I don't know. But anyway, so all the action then takes place across the United States of America, and of course a bit in Canada, because Peter Watts is Canadian. So this the wider world is actually a lot more interesting. Well, not more, a lot more interesting. It's a complete different world from the bottom of the ocean, but it's just as dark and it's just as bleak and it seems to be just as dangerous. Power is very, very expensive to get power from anywhere, because, you know, there's no oil left and the whole political system has collapsed and things like that. And the future is just, I can't say it any other way, except that it's fucking bleak. There's quarantines going everything, there's illnesses, there's viruses going around. And when they quarantine people, they just put a fence around them and nothing gets in and out. Not even, you know, not even any kind of, you know, electrical signals. No messages gets in and out. And if it's needed, you find out that the people inside the quarantined area just almost remove from society. And it takes a long time for all of that to get back to normal, if it ever does get back to normal and things. So also there's a massive surveillance, there's bots flying around all over the place. They're just called bots, these little hovering things which have cameras on them, and they're remote controlled and remote viewed and things, and the satellites keep track of everyone across the whole of North America. And yeah, so very strange politically. Like I say, things are fucked up, there's very little politics going on, everything is run by corporations. But unlike Snow Crash, where everything is run by corporations but everyone still gets to party and hang out and gets along fine and stuff like that, this, you know, really shows, okay, there is no pure motives. Actually, there are some pure motives, but if the motives are pure, they're pure survival of the fittest and pure greed and pure we need power for the sake of power, because if we don't have it, the world is so fucked up and so dangerous that we're just going to lose. Yeah, the world is polluted, the atmosphere is fucked, and the book is, this whole setting is awesome. It's presented in such a cool way, so bleak, I guess I can just keep going back to that word, that there seems to be no hope for anyone, and yet somehow people are hanging on there and surviving. For example, well, let's just get a bit onto the plot, actually, because Lenny Clark, she is like working at the bottom of the ocean. She has two lungs, one lung which is a normal lung, and then when she goes underwater, that lung collapses and all the air is crushed out of it, and then she gets her mechanical underwater, you know, breathing lung that she can use as well, and she can also eat things that she finds underwater. She can drink water under the ocean as well, because she's got a desalination, I guess that's the word, plant in her chest. And yeah, she can just swim underwater, and she's got special eye caps which makes her be able to see in the dark under the water, and she's got a wetsuit which covers her completely, or dry suit, or some kind of material which gels, like it flows like a gel around her body and sticks to her in this black thing, and it covers her completely when she's underwater. It closes up all the way around her, so all that she has is an opening on her chest for water to be pumped in and out. Her mouth is clear and her eyes are clear, even though they're not clear because they're covered up by these eye caps, so she can see in the dark. Really cool image there. Anyway, she's been fucked over and fucked, and has been fucking people at the bottom of the ocean. And not just that, but she's been fucked in a more, again, sort of like metaphorical sense as well. And she wants revenge. I don't want to give away what happens at the end of Maelstrom, but she wants revenge. So she goes about it in the best way that she can figure out. And that is to infect as many people as possible with this super contagious, super strong virus type thing, which is called Behemoth. So she lands after coming at the end of the first book. This book pretty much sets off exactly where the old book ends. So she swims ashore to the coast of California. Now, we find out that where the migrants have come from the flooded coastal areas, they try and make it further into the interior of North America, but they're not allowed. So they put fences up around the entire western seaboard, west coast of America, and people try and get up to the fence and try and get over the fence, but they can't get over the fence, so they're just stuck there. Millions upon millions of people just live along the coast of North America trying to get inland, but they're not allowed because the people inland are trying to keep them away. And so that's where they are. But they're fed there by these machines. So the people on the coast are kept alive, but also they're drugged to keep them placid, to make sure they don't do anything bad or don't try and, invade or don't try and make their way through the fence or try and do anything stupid. And, of course, she realizes she can't survive in this zone. So she has to make it. She wants to make it across country. So she gets out of that quarantine zone and starts making her way across America. Now, the quarantine zones are generally done by, checkpoints and then fences in some points, and other times aerial bombardment, and sometimes it's just things, a firebomb to clear away a zone around the quarantine area, or maybe just to burn the whole quarantine area itself. But she of course has her special abilities, which include being able to swim underwater and also just being a complete badass and being motivated in ways that I can't really understand, but which make her a very interesting character, that she wants this revenge and stuff. So that's pretty much the story, except of course that some people try to stop her and some people try to help her. And then there's some agencies who try to stop her and some other agencies who try to help her. The people who are trying to help her probably don't, it's never clear if they're sure what she's actually doing and that she's actually spreading this disease. But the people trying to stop her are never quite sure if she's a real person or if she exists at all. It's really weird. Again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but the plot itself is actually very simple, and it's very satisfying for being simple. It's a revenge story mixed with a chase story mixed with some conspiracy stuff as well. And then there's this whole part where Lenny somehow becomes this messiah figure. I don't want to spoil how that comes about, but there's this whole religious angles to it as well, and followers and weird stuff too. But like I say, it's all set, it's like a simple story, but because it's set in a world which is so different to ours, it really stands out. I think if the plot was any more complex than it was, it would be a bit too much. Very, very good plot, though. I'm just saying that, putting that out there. Lenny Clark, biggest part of the first book. She's actually less prominent in this book. She's definitely the protagonist, though. She's the one who's going about stuff and making things happen, and everyone is working in reaction to her. But we do spend less time in her head. We pretty much got to know her in the first book, and in this book we don't spend so much time with, time inside her head. But we do get to know some other characters a bit better. There's this one guy who is called Achilles. I can't remember his second name. Desjardins, I guess it's a French name, because he's based in French Canada, in Montreal, which is in a sort of, hey, I'm a Canadian author, I want to make Canada important. So in the future, Canada is going to, that part of Canada is going to be very important. And I'm like, yeah, very good. Then again, he's not the only Canadian author who does this, and he certainly does it a lot less than other authors who will remain unnamed here at this point in this thing. So anyway, he is a special kind of guy, that he's been modified in some way. His brain has been modified in some ways by drugs and by different developments and bioengineering, that he can work with data. He's like a chaos control technician. I can't remember the exact name, technical name, that Peter Watts uses in the book, but he makes hard choices with messy data. He can spot any patterns in any data. It doesn't actually matter to him if it's a big problem, if it's a small problem, if it's a data set about a storm, a data set about a virus spreading, a data set about weather, or any kind of data or any kind of problem that's showing up in the world. He can look at the data and come up with answers to it. He doesn't have to be an expert in that area, but he just needs to look at the patterns in the within the data, and so he can come up with solutions, but he has to come up with a solution which is good. So he's also been pumped full of drugs to keep him loyal to his masters, but specifically to the greater good. He can't do anything which he will feel guilty about. So any situation that he comes into, or any problem that he's got to solve, he can rely on this drug called guilt trip that will stop him carrying out anything which isn't the best option for the greater good in any situation. So of course, immediately we find out that his higher ups in the company that he works for are also feeding. I think they sometimes try and keep him ignorant of some things so he doesn't, you know, so he can actually keep working. Because if you always try and do the right thing at every time, and you know, you don't have the free will to do something wrong or to make any mistakes or anything like that, if you just freeze, it's a bit like, you know, Asimov's kind of robot stories, where you've got the three laws of robotics and they have to be finely tuned, because if you want to obey something to a certain extent, you know, you have to definitely obey humans. You've got to do it that way, but you can't harm humans, so then you can't obey. But then you have to obey, so you do it. But then you're not allowed to harm yourself. So all that kind of stuff, and you have a little of that playing out of the lack of free will within this character. Another character that we have is Periolt. I guess that's how you pronounce her name. And she controls bots. She controls these little spy bots that fly around, and she tracks Lenny as she's traveling throughout America. And she is, I guess, one of the things that to show you that, like, she's a baseline human. All the other characters that we have in the book have been modified in some way, either within their brain or within their body and things like that, and they're all broken people and hardly human people. But Periolt is a baseline broken person, and she shows how difficult it is to get by in the future in this completely fucked up, desolate world, almost lacking in humanity despite humanity trying to survive. And we see that kind of thing from her point of view. Another main character is a guy called Ken Lubin, who was also in the first book. He got away from the Rift Station 2 at the end of the first book, and he's trying to work out what's going on with Lenny and what's going on with the wider world, and he's also wanting to find answers why he and Lenny and the other people down there, all the other rifters at the bottom of the ocean, why they were all fucked up as well. And so, yeah, he's also got guilt trip in him, and he can only do different things, but he's modified in different ways, which I don't want to spoil, but it's amusing to see what, you know, the way that his post-human modifications, I guess that's the way, post-human is one way to look at it, all of these people there as well. The other characters in the book, there's some, you know, interesting characters, there's other characters a little less interesting, but like you say, it's difficult to get a handle on all of them, and some of them do stupid things, but you realise that they're all living in broken times, and they're broken people, and they're modified people as well. Next up, one of my favourite parts of the book is the technology in this book. This is hard science fiction, and there is loads and loads and loads and loads of really cool ideas in this book. And I love the way that they're presented. And because I could explain how it is, but I thought I would just read some out. Lots of things like expressed in like a series of how-tos. It's just like, okay, here's the technology that this guy's using, here it goes. So what they have here, there's a quarantined area, and they've got to work out what's in this quarantined area from a distance, if there's anything dangerous within the quarantined area, you know, from a distance without going into the quarantine area, because it's that dangerous. And I guess there's different ways you could have done it, but here we have a really great invention by Peter Watt. So I guess it's one of his inventions, but it's really cool. I'm just going to read this out, see if you can get the feel of the technology in the book and also a bit of the writing style here. It goes, "Lancing down through the clouds, a precise turquoise stutter of laser light hemistitch its way down a transect 10 kilometers long. Tiny aliquots of sand and flesh incinerated where it touched. Droplets in the saturated air caught the beams in transit and turned them visible to human eyes. Threads of argon so brilliant and beautiful that even looking at them risked sheer perfect blindness. They were fast, too. The light show was over before the cries of pain had even begun. The principle was simple. Everything burns. In fact, everything burns with its own distinct spectrum, subtle interplays of boron and sodium and carbon luminescing in their own special wavelengths, a harmony of light unique to any object cast into flames. In theory, even the combustion of identical twins would generate different spectra, as long as they had different dietary preferences in life. present purposes, of course, didn't require nearly that much resolution. Look here, a strategic patch of real estate. Is it enemy territory? Draw a line through it, but make sure your transect extends into safe land at both ends. Good. Now, sample along the whole path. Turn matter into energy. Read the flames. The end of your transects are the baselines, the ground truth zones. Their light is of the friendly soil. Subtract those wavelengths from whatever you read in between. Pour your numbers through the usual statistics to account for the heterogeneities in local environment. The test was a little over 90% reliable. The powers that be said that was good enough. So you have this really cool way of using, this spectrography. I don't even know what it's called there. The technology behind it there. And you just go in. But it doesn't matter if you're cutting through flesh. It doesn't matter if you're cutting through houses. It doesn't matter. You're just going to burn a path with the laser all the way along through the. And it's just a really great idea. But this kind of thing could only exist in a world where you need to test quarantine zones, but you don't care about human life. Just go, oh, we'll just draw a line through it. And we'll just make a graph along that line. And this kind of thing happens time and time throughout the book. Peter Watts goes, I need some technology for the plot to work, but I don't want to spend too much time on it. So instead of having the characters who know how it works sort of explaining, like being forced into situations where the characters have to explain the technology to each other, he just sets out in exposition, but he writes it in such a cool way and in such a, hey, here's how it works. And if you know anything about technology, you can just keep up. The thing is, if you don't know that much about technology, you'd probably be left a bit far behind. There's lots of stuff in here, because he's a marine biologist, lots of stuff about biology in here. I'm just like going, okay, really? Well, I'm just going to take your word for it. But then there's other stuff about computers where I'm going, oh, right, that's really cool. So, like, the Maelstrom, the title of the book, is actually the state of the internet. It's like a maelstrom of self-replicating viruses that take up the majority of the resources of the internet network. And no matter what human technicians try to do to clear out these replicating viruses, they evolve their way out of trouble. And it leads to very many interesting qualities. I don't want to spoil it now. And then within the Maelstrom, there's Haven, which is the controlled part of Maelstrom. And at each nexus of the network, this organic brain called, I think it's called a head cheese, acts as a way to filter out all of the it's sort of like, almost like a human level intelligence reading everything coming through and saying, okay, that's a virus, that's a virus, that's a virus, that's a virus. Oh, that's not a virus. That's great. That's a virus. That's a virus. It's like what Gmail is now, but they use sort of biological brain neurons to, matter to sort out the entire, internet, and Haven is the nice part of the internet, and Maelstrom is the rest of the internet. And of course, because the book is called Maelstrom, this does come into the book as well in a way that I don't want to spoil. But like I say, the most enjoyable part of this book for me, or one of the most enjoyable parts, is all the ideas and the expertise that he brings as a scientist, as a biologist into this. And even at the end of the book, he's got all these footnotes. Well, not so much footnotes, a whole like appendix at the back, and saying, okay, when I'm talking about this, I cribbed this from here, I stole this idea from here, this part I made up, but this part is based on real technology. Also quite interesting. Getting onto the writing style, mostly third person, the technical parts in there as well. When the technical part sometimes breaks into non-narrative kind of elements of writing. So you get some like copies of computer printouts or lists or sort of found documents, some transcripts here and there. And I love that kind of thing. And if you've read actually my first novel, you'll find similar stuff within there as well, where people break away and you get different information from different ways, like an email exchange or, transcripts and things like that. But the narration itself is pretty sparse and relentless. And you've got to pay attention to every word, because there's some crucial clues that you throw up that you don't want to miss. There's actually quite a few chapters where, if I was a bit distracted when I read it, I was like, right, I'm going to have to go back and read through that again. And you have to do it, because if you miss something early, you'll miss something later on, and maybe something won't make sense. I think I got most of what was going on in the book, but even then it is very complex. But it's a kind of complexity that I really enjoy. Finally, I'm going to talk a bit about the themes. Normally I talk quite a lot. I'm not going to go into too much details here. But one of the main things that I find, because the world is so grim and the people who live in it are so, so fucked up and broken, it's one of the main messages seems to be, if we're going to fuck up the world, like we're probably going to do, we've got to change as humans to survive. The book itself is bleak, but I don't think it's presented as a worst case scenario, even if, you know, it is an apocalyptic book. It's it's not a post-apocalyptic. You could think it's post-apocalyptic. No, it's post-apocalyptic, and then another apocalypse is coming. And yet, I think there's still some kind of hope within the book as well. Humanity survives in some form, but to survive, they are changing themselves away from what you could think of as baseline human. But what would be worse from that is if humanity didn't want to change at all to face the problems that it itself is causing and didn't, you know, and then didn't survive at all. Like Lenny Clark, who has a hole in her chest where she can breathe and survive underwater, is sort of like an emblem for changing humanity and going, you know, managing to make the way in the world against all the odds to get through. She gets through the quarantine zones. She's like, that's what I say, she becomes almost like this messiah figure, that she can stand up against the world in a way that other people can't. And the only reason she can do that is because she is broken and she is not, you know, baseline human anymore. So you can actually use your brokenness, you can use your faults, you can use all the things that which aren't healthy within a human being to make you survive. And if you're a healthy human being, you probably won't survive. And the very things that define people as human in like a classic science fiction examination, to survive in the future, those things might have to go, like free will. I was mentioning it before about like the Asimov robots and stuff, and to become human, you know, what's it in the Bicentennial Man? It's sort of like the only one who becomes human, the only robot who becomes a human who actually wants to call himself a human is the robot who has free will, even though he can't harm humans and he has to still follow the three laws of robotics. He's the one who becomes most human. And, you know, because of his extra free will that he has there, he decides to do things which he hasn't been ordered to do. You know, he actually creates artwork and all that kind of thing. And then again, in Blade Runner, you've got compassion and empathy is one of the main things that makes people human rather than replicants and stuff. And love as well. You know, all these different things which are an intelligence. Too, you'd think that intelligence makes us human, but within this book, it really goes to show that all of these things that make us human, well, not all of them, but quite a few of them might have to be sacrificed for humans to survive in a world which is as fucked up as it is in this book, as bleak as it is in this book. And even the idea that, you know, humans have to have eyes and that they have to walk and talk, called into question by Lenny Clark herself. It's like, why do we need lungs when you can breathe underwater? Why do you need, you know, to use eyes? Or why do you need to be able to speak when you've got a vocoder in your voice? Because, you know, air can't pass your vocal cords. So you've got to have like a vocoder which talks for you when you're underwater. And all these different things about being a human that you have to strip them away to survive and to keep humanity survive. Another reason why this book is so... Oh, yeah, and that's why this book is so grim, is because it's actually presenting the future of humanity as a world where you have to lose your humanity to stay human or to even survive. And another thing which makes it so grim is that it's hard science fiction. All of the stuff in the book seems possible, even plausible in some ways. The way that the world is fucked up and the viruses that are going around and the energy crisis and the wars that take place and the people moving in and being, you know, set up in these quarantine areas and just people being killed left, right and center, it seems more plausible than it is in normal, like, you know, post-apocalyptic Mad Max kind of world, because the technology behind it is set out and the science behind it is set out in such a clear way. It's like, yeah, this leads to this, A to B, B to C, C to D, D to fucked up society, and it's a bit more, and it lends sort of like a credibility to the sense of horror which isn't possible when there's even like a slight fantasy element in there or anything like that. However, you got to take it to the next step. It's these chaotic catastrophes, that's hard to say, they seem very real, but there's no hope at any point that some character is just going to invent their way out of the mess. Like, no character is, or no agency is just going to go, ah, so there's this thing that's coming in here. Oh, all we need to do is put the Fijima flop in the Hujima big and do this and then do that. Connect these two things, program the computer in a different way and everything's going to go like that. They can't wave any magic wand. There isn't anything like that here. Because, like I say, the science is hard, and anyone who's doing the science has to do the science which they actually have to do the science to get to the science. It's not like most science fiction where people don't have to work 20 years on a problem to solve it. They just go, oh, I'll just pop to the lab and come out 5 minutes later and go, yep, the blood's been analyzed. This guy did it. This is what we need to do. It's science doesn't work like that. It's messy. It takes a long time. And unfortunately, in this book, you realize that, oh, wait a second, humanity can't just wave a magic wand and come up with different ideas. They tried that in the past, and what happened? Fucked up the world. And also, like, another thing that makes this book even more grim is that the people who are getting us into the mess, like Lenny Clark, isn't a hero. She's an anti-hero, and we find ourselves rooting for her, and it's like, yay, yay, go Lenny, woohoo, survive. And you're like, wait a second, if she survives, that means, like, a whole of humanity might die. And then you're still going, woohoo, go Lenny Clark, yay. But then you read that the rest of the society within the book as well is also holding her up as a messiah figure, as, you know, this, but not realizing that she's not the Christ, she's the Antichrist. She's the one of the four horsemen of the, or horsewoman of the apocalypse that's coming in here. And again, that's not spoiling it too much, but there's definitely that element going on here as well. So, grim book, dark book, from every angle possible to write darkness. So, this book is one of my favorite books that I've read in a long time. I'm going to give it 4.5 stars out of 5, but let me just say, not recommending this to everyone. If you don't want to put up with technical language, this is maybe not for you. If you don't want darkness and grimness, if you don't want to read a book where you actually think everyone's going to die in the end and you're meant to think that's the cool thing, this book might not be for you. But that kind of book is for me. You know, there's lots of other books. I like reading, you know, happy science fiction too, but sometimes I want to read something where at the end of it I just go, fuck me. But actually, the end of this book is awesome. Yeah, awesome. So that's my review. Oh, let me check out goodreads.com before I continue here. Goodreads.com, friends review. Oh, three people. Alan marked it as to read. Derek wants to read it. Robert wants to read it. Nobody else has read it. None of the other friends. But generally on goodreads.com, it gets 3.77 out of 5 stars by the aggregate goodreads.com reviewers. I actually think it's a lot better book than the first book, and I actually wrote an email to Peter Watts, because we've actually emailed back and forth about other things as well, and I said, hey, better book than the first book. And he actually says, let me just see his email. He says, you have company either way. A lot of people love Starfish and thought Maelstrom was a complete disappointment. Totally different pacing, more emphasis on plot, less ambience. And then there are other people who thought that Starfish was okay, but stood up and cheered for Maelstrom. I'm sort of in the second group here. But then he says, check this out. He says, you should probably stop reading now, though. I know maybe two or three folks who thought Behemoth was the crowning jewel of the trilogy. Everyone else, not so much. Yeah, as she said, I think for me not to read Behemoth now, it's got to be a big, big, big step down for the third book in this trilogy. Even if it is a big step down, I think I'll still probably enjoy it. I definitely want to find out what happens with Lenny Clark and the world that she's living in and the people that she's influencing and the Maelstrom and Behemoth and Haven and all the other things that are going on here within the book. So I'm looking forward to that. Also, I did mention at the end of the review last time a bit about Peter Watts. I said don't go and read his blog for the pictures there. Well, just a little bit into this, he got this necrotic. He had this biopsy, this little skin sample taken from his leg, and it got infected with something which literally ate away the flesh of his leg. And so it's quite funny that one of the chapters within this book is called Necrosis, and it's talking about, you know, things eating away other things. And actually, Peter Watts says back, he says, if you think Necrosis was ironic, the book that I just wrote before getting the damn disease, the book that came out about a month after he got the disease, has a spot where the protagonist was going on at length about his pimped-out, weaponized iteration of necrotizing facilities? Facetis, I can't even read the word there, that he'd seen at work in the field. And then he says, I got to start writing about people who win the lottery, because he writes about stuff and it's happening to him. Or that's what it feels like. So, yeah, interesting guy, interesting blog, especially if you like looking at pictures of holes in people's legs. Anyway, Next book, well, a book I'm reading at the moment, I'm reading Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny as an audiobook, and also Philip K. Dick's Ubik, or Ubik, however you pronounce that, and enjoying them both. I'll probably get to the review of Ubik first, probably in about 3 or 4 days' time. And so stick around for that. Otherwise, you can email me, luke@juggler.net. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge at Twitter. You can check out my blog on my website. I'm lukeburridge.com/blog. Or to check out my blog, or fiction.html if you want to see some stuff that I've written myself. I actually have like one book almost completely finished. I've just got to write the last chapter, but it's the last book in my Minding Tomorrow series. And what I want to do is, because of ebooks, there's nothing actually written on paper. There's no final version of these at the moment. So I'm going to go back through and edit all of Minding Tomorrow, all of Combat, and then all of Minding Tomorrow Part 3, whatever it's going to be called, and not edit into a single novel, but I want to go through and like finish it off as a like do a final version of all three stories within the third within at the same time, and then release the third book as well. So that's it. Otherwise, follow me on goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. You can find me there, and you can recommend books to me there as well. I think that's everything. So that's it. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.